Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich of the Eurasian and Russian Studies channel. When Russia occupied the Crimea in 2014, sparking a series of conflicts that continue to this day with Ukraine, a new term appeared, which was called hybrid warfare. But what is hybrid warfare, and are the Russians the true masters of this supposedly new form of warfare? These issues will be the subject of this episode as I interview Ofer Friedman on his book, Russian Hybrid Warfare, Resurgence and Politicization, that was published by Oxford University Press. Originally published in 2018, we will be discussing the recent 2022 edition. Ofer Friedman is Director of Operations at the King's Center for Strategic Communications and a Research Fellow at the Department of War Studies at King's College in London. Ofer Friedman, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we usually like to begin our interviews by asking our guests, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what motivated you to write this book? And maybe if you could, because this is an updated version of your book that we're discussing, maybe why did you update it from the 2018 edition?
I woke up one day back in 2015 and suddenly realized that everyone in the field was talking about hybrid warfare, which was probably in the context, which not necessarily probably, it was definitely in the context of previous year annexation of Crimea. And two interesting books navigated their ways onto my table back in 2015. One of them was about hybrid warfare, published by NATO, and another one was about Gibridna Vayna, which is hybrid warfare in Russian, published in Russia. Now, as an expert in the field, when I approach Russian publication and Western publication on the same topic, let's say asymmetric warfare, counterinsurgency, and so on, well, they will write more or less about the same thing with slightly different views on it, and which is rooted in different historical experience, cultural approaches, and so on. But if I have a book about terrorism written in Russia and terrorism written in the West, they will more or less speak about terrorism. Now, what fascinated me about these two books was that they had the same title. They claimed to speak about the same thing, but actually they spoke about completely different concepts. This was the puzzle to solve. How operating by the same words that actually came up with different conceptualizations, this is what motivated me to kind of go into the blue waters of conceptual discourses in the West and in Russia, trying to understand the origins of both of the terms, both of the discourses, how they have been shaped, and what does it mean to the relationship between the West and Russia. And it resulted in the original publication of the book in 2018, as you mentioned. But again, it was published in 2018, so it was written mainly in 15 and 16. And as we're all aware, many things have happened since then. Just before the invasion of Ukraine in February, I said to myself, okay, much discourse has happened since then, both in Western Russia. So let's try and write an update. One of my main arguments in the book that it's kind of, you know, the perception shapes the reality, with the reality shapes the perception, and the language, the discourse, it's actually the way into this circle of perceptions and realities. And one of the main arguments in the original book was basically what we can observe in this discourse back in 15, 16, 17, and 18 is how these two sides, the West and Russia, slowly talk themselves into the wall. They both claim to conduct war one against another. And my main argument was, well, if this is the perception of the reality, we should await and see how, you know, the war is imminent. You know, this is how both sides perceive the reality, and they slowly will talk both themselves into it. So now we should not be surprised that actually we have a war, because we've been talking about the war for the last 8 years.
Yeah, so just can you kind of briefly summarize, like, what do we mean by this concept of hybrid warfare for our audience, just to give them a basic idea? And we'll definitely go into more detail as we continue on with the interview, because I know it's a real complex concept.
Well, it's not necessarily complex, it's complicated. And there is a difference. First of all, since the publication of the book back, four years ago, I've been constantly given lectures and talks about hybrid warfare. And a very interesting experiment that I usually conduct when I arrive to give a talk to a military audience or to an academic audience is to ask them to tell me what is hybrid war. Usually I will get as many answers as people in the audience. It's not complex, it's complicated, because everyone can put inside whatever they want to put inside. Clearly, if you dive deep into this multiple definitions, you can see clearly three main families of definitions in different words. The first family of definitions of hybrid warfare is kind of the original conceptualization, which was born long before annexation of Crimea. It was popular mainly in the United States military circles. It was originated, coined, and promoted by Frank Hoffman within U.S. Theoretical discourse about the character of contemporary warfare. It has very little to do with what happened in Ukraine in 2014. So this is the first family, which basically implies that you have a combination of irregular and regular tactics, methods, formations on the same battlefield. And to credit Frank for this, there is some novelty in this concept. All war partisans and regular forces have been fighting together for, I don't know, hundreds of years. There is nothing new in that. They rarely were fighting on the same battlefield. Even if we take the Second World War, the Soviet partisans were fighting their wars, the regular army was fighting their wars. And all historical cases will go back to American Revolution, Napoleonic Wars. Partisans and regular forces were fighting for the same actor, but on different battlefields. And what we could see more clearly in the beginning of the 21st century, and especially his case study, was the Second Lebanon War, where Hezbollah actually came and brought together on the same battlefield both types of warfare, regular and irregular, together, presenting one unified, combined threat to a regular army. In that case, was the idea. So this is one family. And it's important to say that this is a very military approach to battlefield. It's about how battlefield looks like and what I am as a military commander, what kind of enemy I will find there. The second family refers to what grew up out of this after the annexation of Crimea, mainly within NATO. And it applies everything from conventional military force to completely non-military means, brought together whatever opponent does and we don't like. This is hybrid warfare. If the opponent invades us with special forces, it's hybrid warfare. But also if opponent distributes disinformation or use economic coercion, it's hybrid warfare. So it's all sources of power combined together against an opponent. And then there is a Russian conceptualization of Hybridna Vojna, which, by the way, was also adopted by later on by certain organizations and institutions in the West, like the European Center of Excellence for Countering Hybrid Threats. They developed it by themselves. They didn't adopt Russian, but it's in the same family, that all different activities conducted by opponents short of war, short of conventional force. So if you put it on the spectrum between military and non-military means, on the military means side, you will have the original Hoffman conceptualization. On the non-military side, you will have Russian Hybridna Vojna, and NATO understanding of hybrid warfare will include them all. Everything that opponent does and we don't like becomes a hybrid warfare.
Yeah, and you mentioned Frank Hoffman and his original conception of the concept due to the Second Lebanon War. But where did he get this concept from? You mentioned that there were some sources that he used that synthesized them all, like you call unrestricted warfare, fourth generation warfare, and compound warfare. Can you explain these concepts and how Hoffman was able to use these to conceive of hybrid warfare?
Well, during the 90s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the general disappearance of the conventional threat to the West, different people, different organizations have been trying to conceptualize the new character of warfare. And then we have unrestricted warfare, which actually originates in China. And this is how Chinese in the late 90s looked back to, especially to the First Gulf War, trying to conceptualize the contemporary character of war, which was then translated and picked up very short-lived in the early 2000s within the American discourse. I think the title itself, Unrestricted Warfare, doesn't do a good job for the concept, because the original, if you translate it directly, it means warfare that goes beyond the boundaries, which is not necessarily unrestricted. And the main concept was there that in the contemporary environment, warfare will be all about mixing and matching on different levels, different capabilities, different methods on intrastate, superstate, between different branches. It's all about combination and creating a more suitable cocktail, mixing the most suitable cocktail. This is the metaphor that they use, rather than conceptual boxes of the Western thinking. This is regular, this is irregular, this is insurgency, this is terrorism, this is limited, and so on and so on. This was an idea to come and say, well, actually, let's go beyond the boundaries of our conceptual intellectual boxes. So this was the first concept that kind of inspired Frank Hoffman. The second concept was fourth generation warfare, which probably our American listeners are most familiar with. It was developed in the late 80s, just close to the end of the Cold War, and actually took a much more influential platform position in 90s, 2000. Until today, there's much talk about fourth generation warfare. And it's the whole history of kind of trying to understand different ways, and there's the first wave of about manpower, and then the firepower, and then this, and the whole idea of the fourth generation warfare is that the battlefield has changed, and actually today the influence of the battlefield is not on the battlefield itself, it's on the heart and minds of the decision makers. And now when you plan your fight and you plan your war and operation, it's important to understand that the strategic effects on decision makers, not necessarily winning on the battlefield. And then compound warfare, which probably least familiar among these three, it actually was developed both in the United States by several American historians, came and said, well, when we look back in history, there are certain relations between irregular and irregular forces. So occasionally, the actor that employs them both can not use them separately, but they can use them together where the sum is greater than the simple sum of both, and they compound one to another. So yeah, these are the three that Hoffman discussed by himself, trying to say, okay, this is the inspiration. We have this discourse for a decade where it's all about something combination, something an idea that tries to bring together and blend our traditional isolated understandings of warfare. And this is where he looks at the Second Lebanon War, specifically on Hezbollah. Later on, he analyzes some other cases where this combination, this hybrid of traditionally regular and traditionally irregular forces and capabilities are combined together to present one unified threat to a conventional military.
Yeah, now how did this concept kind of develop over the decades since Hoffman originally originated this concept? Because he did it in around 2008, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
And so in that decade since he first originated it, how did it kind of develop?
So he produced several interesting publications among interesting most influential American military publications. It started to slowly penetrate into the discourse. It has never been adopted by American military as a concept or something. It slowly started to penetrate. Obviously, like with any concept, there are advocates and there are opponents, and the discourse has been developing there for years. Interestingly enough, in 2012, NATO tried to pick up, in 2010, NATO tried to pick up this concept and see what they can do. The problem was that the concept was very tactical operational, right? It was military concept for military commanders, how to understand the reality of the battlefield. NATO, on the other hand, it's a strategy, grand strategy organization. They leave the tactical operations to the member states and the member state militaries. So they try to kind of elevate this idea of hybridity, of combination, to the level of strategy, trying to say, okay, we like the hybrid, we like the combination, so let's bring all sources of power together and see how that will produce a threat. Also, we have to remember it's 2010, so Russia is not in the news yet. What we have in the news is international terrorism. So they tried it for a few years, but then in 2012, they said, well, there's not much interest among the member states to invest in kind of further developing and of that kind of capabilities. And they officially closed the shelter on all discussions. They wished luck to member states to continue developing these ideas by themselves. They stopped conceptual developing of this. And it continued in the United States for quite a while, until obviously 2014 happened, which was a strategic surprise for NATO and the West. They didn't know how to think about it. And this is where this concept was resurrected, quite artificially, by the way, and unintentionally, because whatever Russians did there did not fit that concept. So they had to reconceptualize it from scratch. Interestingly enough, I discussed it in the book, but it was popularized by a journalist in a very influential publication in NATO magazine, without being aware that this term has been popularized by him, without being aware of the whole Hoffman conceptualization before. And then it was just picked up. So it was not done intentionally. It just happened.
Now we move from NATO Western military to Russian military thinking, and you speak a little, quite a bit about Yevgeny Messner, and what is his significance to the history of Russian military theory, especially as it relates to this concept of hybrid warfare, or Gibridnaya Vyna, as we'll discuss in a few minutes.
Yeah, so now he completely independently from whatever was going on in the West, in Russia has been. And Russian military thinking and military science is famous for its discourses and attempts to understand the nature and character of warfare, and occasionally even trying to conceptualize certain activities and capabilities which they have no chance of having. So completely independently, since the beginning of the 90s, there was a discourse in Russia, in Russian military circles and academic circles, of about the nature of contemporary war. Now, it's important to remember that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Marxist-Leninism also collapsed. And for Russian military circles, Marxist-Leninism was the philosophy that explained war. Any war eventually was explained as a continuation of the class struggle. The philosophy of Marxist-Leninism was deeply integrated with the philosophy of war. With the collapse of that, they kind of in the 90s, they found themselves, okay, so what is war? We need to reestablish our philosophy of war and how we should understand this phenomenon. So they went on a long way of exploration into a different school, not necessarily Western one, which is something I discussed in my other book. But eventually they rediscovered many Russian thinkers from imperial time, but also Russian thinkers in exile. And Messner, Yevgeny Messner, obviously was one of them. Back during the Cold War, he was trying to conceptualize different subversion activities conducted by the Soviet Union against the West. Now, in the 90s and early 2000s, his idea of subversion war, or Mitezh Vayna, which is in Russian, became quite popular in Russian because it was providing an explanation for the loss of the Soviet Union. Soviet Union did not lose war on the battlefield. We can argue about the true reasons, about the dissolution of the Soviet Union. We can say it was economic mismanagement. We can say it was people became less delusional with the party. We can provide many arguments, but from the perspective of the Russian military, the Soviet Union lost because of the Western subversion. Now, Whether it's true or not, it doesn't matter. This is what they believed in. And the theory of Messner provided a good explanation of how it happened. So in the 90s, 2000s, his conceptual framework of subversion war has been used to kind of understand how subversion is used below the threshold of actual war.
Now, another figure you mentioned is Alexander Dugin, who has been in the news quite a lot over the past few years, and even just within very recently due to the assassination attempt on August 2022, which killed his daughter eventually. But what is his significance to this discourse on post-Soviet military theory?
Alexander Dugin, indeed, he became to be prominent, mainly among the West and experts and discussions rather than Russia. He is not very popular in Russia, but he plays a very important role in the discourse. So he is even too extreme thinker for the Kremlin. But he serves a very important role because he's positioned so much on the right extreme of the discourse, and he's allowed to be there by the Kremlin, because we're all aware figures who are not allowed by the Kremlin to be where they are not going to be there where they are. You know, the balconies are too slippery in Moscow or St. Petersburg. But he's allowed to be there, but his job is crucial, because what he does, he justifies the whole discourse in the middle. Because many extreme thinkers or right thinkers can come and always say, well, what do you want from me? I'm not Dugin, right? So basically legitimizing this whole discourse between Dugin and the center. So this is the role of Dugin. Now, Dugin does not necessarily speak about military thinking. He speaks about geopolitical confrontations, right? Which are conducted usually not by military means, but non-military means. And his idea of Necentric War, which he developed in the mid-2000s, basically spoke more or less in the same language as Messner, but about how subversion is conducted against Russia by the West, what Russia should do to defend against this subversion, and how to conduct subversion against. Again, it's not necessarily has to be true. This is what they believe in. This is their perception of the reality. The same applies on Igor Panarin, which is the third theorist that I use in my book. He's a former KGB officer, and he started to write about this term, which is called information war, since the early 90s. Again, he expressed exact same ideas. So what happened back in 2014, when Russians suddenly found themselves being accused of conducting hybrid war by the West, right? The West accused Russia of doing hybrid war in Ukraine. Hybrid war, hybridna vojna, was not a part of Russian lexicon before. So what they said, okay, we need to go and investigate what we're actually accused of. But instead of going to Hoffman or going even to the NATO discussion, they Russified the concept. They basically took main theories or most dominating concepts in this discourse about non-military confrontation or non-military means in geopolitical confrontations, which was with Messner's and Dugin and Panarin and many others, who I also mentioned in the book, and try to distill it into one unified concept. This is where they came up with hybridna vojna, which essentially implies a combination of non-military means, economic, political, diplomatic, informational, and so on and so on, and also military, but not for military purposes. So it's about projection of power and the new equipment and other things that can be used to influence opponents. And this is how Gibridna Vojna entered Russian lexicon. But again, it entered mainly as something that the West does against Russia, right? No Russian scholar will accept that Russia does Gibridna Vojna against the West. Similarly, like in the NATO discussion or Western discussion, hybrid warfare is something Russia does, or China or any other opponent. Well, no Western scholar or expert or professional will actually accept the idea that actually the West might also do hybrid warfare against its opponents.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, an underlining theme that I got from the book was from reading all these different theories of hybrid war or Gibridna Vojna was there's this underlining idea of Russia versus the West as if the Cold War never ended. Is that kind of a correct assessment in your view?
Well, yes and no. The Cold War ended for a very short period of time. And then it was either resurrected or it just resurged by itself. It's a completely different story. But as I said in the beginning of our conversation, somewhere in the early 2000s, we can see how discourse on both sides have been shaping in a military confrontational terms. And assuming that, you know, perception shapes reality, that shapes perception, we should not be surprised that once this wheel was initiated, but the circle was initiated on both sides, it's slowly progressed into what we have today.
Now, another figure who is often brought up in regards to Gibridna Vojna, at least in the West, is the figure of General Valery Gerasimov, and especially with the so-called Gerasimov doctrine that was coined by Mark Gagliardi, I believe. And what role does this play in the discourse, at least in the West, on Russian hybrid warfare?
Well, the Gerasimov doctrine is a nonsense. And even Mark Gagliardi, who invented the term, later on officially apologized for that invention in writing. So kind of, it's important to remember. For a while, especially since 2014, 15, for several years, I think it was quite popular among the Western military circles. In my opinion, it was complete misunderstanding of Russia, Russian military thinking. There were many people who came against it within the discourse, tried to stop it, but it was catched fire for a while, I think, misleading the West from the right direction. And interesting to see how, so Gibridna Vaina, the Russian concept of hybrid warfare, similarly like in the United States, has never been adopted officially. Right? It has never been a part of a Russian military dictionary or something, or doctrinal publications. But it has been used by Russian military. Because, first of all, even Gerasimov doctrine, as it was not written by Gerasimov. The articles, the main principles of this article were written by Sergei Chekhinov and Sergei Bogdanov, which you can trace in their publications, all main themes of this, of all Gerasimov's articles later. But what happened in this kind of political military relations within Russia, because of these discourses of the rising roles of non-military means within Russian political expert community, academic community, at certain point, especially in the early 2010, the military started to feel threatened by this discourse. Theoretically, if the government now believes that the conflict can be won only by non-military means, we don't need military. So the military adopted this idea of non-military confrontations, including Gibridna Vaina, to separate and provide a clear conceptual line, saying, okay, it's all fine, but true wars are won by tanks and planes. And if you want us to win true wars, give us money for tanks and planes. This was the main line of Gerasimov's speech. He was referring to non-military means, to informational struggle, and all this kind of stuff. But if you draw the line in his speeches and kind of focus between the lines and what he actually was trying to communicate among all different speeches and articles that he published, he was constantly saying, yes, this idea of Gibridna Vaina is a nice idea. It has nothing to do with war. It's a geopolitical confrontation, which are fine. But if you want to win a war, or if you want us as a military institution in Russia to provide security and be an important tool of decision making, you need to give us money. We need new tanks, new rockets, and new planes. And then it will be war. And we need to prepare for that. So coming back to that, we need to separate and truly understand the role of Gibridna Vaina within the discourse in Russia. It was quickly adopted by the political institution, especially politicians on the right side of the political map, who could come and say, look, the West is trying to subvert us. And it was adopted to a certain extent by the military and popularized by the military to say, well, it's all fine and nice, but it's not a war. Although we call it Gibridna Vaina, we'll call it hybrid war, it's not a true war. It's a geopolitical confrontation. It's fine. The government should manage it. When it comes to wars, wars are when shells are falling from the skies, and you need to give us money for that.
Yeah, almost new twist on the term Cold War, which was used for that confrontation between the Soviet Union and NATO. Now, when Russia occupied Crimea in 2014, and then, of course, there was also the war in the Donbas, this had some wider impact of where hybrid warfare got catapulted into the popular discourse in the West. And you talk about like some of the wider impact this had on politics in many different Western countries, where almost Russia becomes this ubiquitous boogeyman. Can you explain how this happened?
Well, yeah. So first of all, on the mechanics of popularization of hybrid warfare. So the annexation happened in May 2014, and whatever Russians did in Crimea didn't fit any conceptual box of the Western military thinking. And so they try to come up and explain and so on. Now, in summer 14, in late June, NATO magazine, which is a civilian managed publication of NATO, produced a very short documentary based on a conference organized by NATO about annexation of Crimea. And the title of this short video was Hybrid War, Hybrid Response. And then during the second part of the summer, several big conferences were organized by different NATO member states, mainly East European, Romanians, Bulgarians, and so on, who actually published articles and created this discourse, where they referred to this documentary, saying, well, you see, this NATO already recognizes that what Russians did is hybrid warfare. Now, when I interviewed the director of this video and asked him, okay, so why did you call it hybrid warfare? You know, there was a whole concept about it. Were you aware of this? He said, I had no idea that this concept there. What Russians did in Crimea, they combined different things, and hybrid seems more evil than combination. And then this is that all started this snowball. And it was very useful for the same political reasons, especially within NATO and among European member militaries, and in their negotiation for budget and for influence within with their own government. You know, Russia did many things that Western European countries didn't like. Well, to start with, it occupied Crimea and supported separatists in Ukraine. But then there was all this disinformation and subversion and economic use of economic tools to coerce countries to do different things. And then we get to the Brexit and the elections of Trump in 2016. So Russia did many things. Now, when you come to decision making and say, well, Russia does that, and Russia does that, and Russia does that, and that requires that response, and that. It's too complicated to make decisions, and especially to ask for funding. Now, when you put everything into one basket, hybrid warfare, Russian hybrid warfare, and instead of specifying, okay, there are like, you know, there are trees there, and then there are bushes, and then there is grass, there is a forest. Like, okay, it becomes much easier into internal political discourse. And this is why hybrid warfare became so popular. The problem with that it misinterprets the reality. And the second problem with that is that as military institution, NATO and also militaries of member states have little to do with hybrid warfare, right? We don't expect our military to regulate our information space, to stop Russia from conducting or distributing disinformation. We don't expect our military to make economic decisions and cut off Russian supply of gas or our dependency on Russian gas. So it's because it puts in the basket, which is called warfare, we ultimately think, okay, this is a security issue, the military and security services should deal with it. But actually, the vast majority of activities included in this basket of non-military nature, and military, especially in democratic countries, have very little toolbox to address them.
Now, you also talk about how Gibranaya Vaina had deep impacts in Russian politics, and we've discussed elements of that. Can you expand on that point of what impact that's had on Russian politics?
Well, again, in Russian politics, it has been also politicized, but for slightly different reasons. So it was politicized by the politicians and organizations on the right side of the map, political map, to accuse the West of subversion of Russia or attempts of subversion of Russia. or even kind of try to connect it to the kind of historical developments and go all back to the conquest of Vienna when after Napoleonic Wars, you know, when British and Austrians conspired against Russia and all these kind of stories. So it was used by them to close their ranks among themselves, but also with the establishment in certain parts of the Russian population. We have to remember, Russians are a very proud nation. And they also had to justify to themselves, or explain at least, the fall of the Soviet Union. And it's much easier to blame the other rather than to look at yourself. Right? It's much easier to say, okay, these are the West who subverted us, and this subversion has never ended, and so on and so on. And so on. So it's been used there, but the military was politicized for different reasons, right? While the Western military institutions, especially NATO, have been saying, there is a Russian hybrid warfare, there is a hybrid warfare, we can help you, give us money, we need to address this threat. This was the politicization of hybrid warfare in the West. In Russia, it was slightly different, for the same purpose, although, but slightly different discourse. It was, well, hybridная война is nice. We are not responsible for that. The secret services and the government responsible for that. But let's not get confused. This is not a war. The true war is conducted by planes and ships and rockets and tanks. And for true war, give us money and give us resources, because we need to be prepared to fight a true war. So both of the, on both sides of the new Iron Curtain, if you like, hybridная война or hybrid warfare have been very useful, politically speaking, for the military establishments and for certain political establishments as well, institutions and so on. The problem is that it's conceptually wrong. It does not present the reality as it is. And the main problem, it doesn't help to understand the opponent standing in front of me.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, like, do you think this concept is helpful or hindering? But I think you just answered that. Now, you originally published this book in 2018, and you just came out with a new revised edition. How has the discourse on hybrid warfare evolved since you first published this book? And maybe if you have any thoughts on whether or not it's still continuing with the ongoing war in Ukraine.
Well, first of all, it has been institutionalized, and I address it in the new introduction and the new foreword to the book. So we have now centers who study hybrid warfare or hybrid threats all across Europe. It becomes to be part of institution. In my opinion, it's a mistake. It's a conceptual mistake. Russia does many bad things or subversive things. There's no denial of that. But to see this through that prism, it's misfortune. Simultaneously, in the United States, and this is what another important addition to the new edition of the book. Meanwhile, in the last decade, in the United States, another concept grew up in prominence, which is gray zone. And they mainly speak about the same thing, which is, in my opinion, another bankrupt conceptualization. Simply, we are talking here about hostile international relations. This is what we're talking about. And there is little new in that. Throughout history, countries didn't like each other. And occasionally, they didn't like each other, but they couldn't fight each other on the battle for a whole set of different reasons. And they tried to do nasty things to each other without actually fighting. Let's not forget that France supported the American Revolution for 4 years, having peace with Britain, because they couldn't fight Britain right back then. And only by the end of the revolution, they actually declared war on Britain. But they provided supplies, they supported the training, soldiers, and so on and so on. So it's a part of international relations. It has always been part of international relations. And countries that don't like each other but could not fight each other for either they have no capability, desire, or they both have nuclear weapons and they just, deter from doing it, will do nasty things to each other. It's called hostile international relations. There is no warfare there. There is no war there. Unless there is a war, and then it's a completely different story. Now, to call hostile international relations as a war, a warfare, it's a very slippery slope. And as I demonstrate in the new edition, it's kind of the book. Well, for 8 years, since 2014 until February 2022, we've been calling hostile international relations as a war. So we should not be surprised that we found ourselves in a war after all. So I refer to that, and I develop some other, in the final chapter, I develop some other ideas about this fashionable idea of blending war and peace. Russian activities or gray zone or hybrid warfare, they're blending, blurring the line between war and peace, which is another conceptual oxymoron. There has never been a line between war and peace. Where is the line? If somebody can say, where is the line between war and peace? Right? Then we can blur it. But different countries, different cultures put this line differently. And in different societies, and even in the same societies, but in different time periods, whatever constituted war changed. And the line has been shifted accordingly. So when you have a clash between two states or two cultures who have this line in different places, you can't blur it because they can't establish where it is.
Now, do you have any view on how NATO should be dealing with Russia, especially in light of the ongoing war with Ukraine?
Well, I think NATO should not deal with Russia. I know it sounds controversial, I will explain. The NATO and generally collective West, let's say, in interest and values rather than geographical, right, need to decide what they want for themselves. And if so, their response to Russia should not be driven by Russia. Their response to Russia should be driven by the vision of the world in which they want to live, or the world they want to construct and build. Now, if that vision requires certain actions against or with Russia, then it should be conducted. This is called grand strategy, right? So it's not about what we need to do with Russia. Whatever we need to do with Russia, it's tactical. And it needs to fit into a greater vision of the world that we want to live in. And I think the West currently is lost on that. We're trying to tactically react to Russia, to China, to Iran. We'll say Americans are trying to react. We are in this tactical loop of reactions, which are not connected necessarily to in what world we want to live. We should not be surprised that now we can see clearly the global South is not with us, or at least on the Ukrainian issue. It's not necessarily that they support Russia. They're for themselves, and they intend certain connections with Russia for their own benefit. We need to decide what kind of world we want to live in. Are we now on defense, or are we trying to bring communities around? Maybe the way to deal with Russia is not necessarily sending more weapons and troops and training to Ukraine, which is important, but maybe it's actually creating a global consensus against Russia, which is different, two completely different activities to deal with Russia. So it's a little bit high, but I think if you already asked this question, the question here is not how NATO should deal with Russia. The question is here, well, if the question is focused on NATO, how NATO member states want to build their future and their place in the world, what kind of world they want to build. And then within the context of that vision, to find the most suitable way to deal with Russia that can be not necessarily directly supporting Ukraine, or maybe it is, or maybe it is a sort of combined actions trying to win the heart and mind of the rest of the world, which is the majority of the world is not with us on that. If we take it in kind of in economic terms, India, China, Pakistan, Indonesia, they're not with whole Africa, they're not with us. So the main economy is not with us. Population speaking, well, it's enough China and India, the majority of this globe, of this world, population speaking, does not support the West in this war. Does not support Ukraine. Sorry, the West is not fighting the war. Does not support Ukraine and the Western position in this war. So maybe the way to deal with Russia is to address that.
This has been a very fascinating discussion. Do you have any concluding thoughts or touch on any topics we didn't discuss already?
I think we are past the point where the usefulness of hybrid warfare, because it has never been useful conceptually, it was useful politically. We're past the point, we have an actual war ongoing on in Ukraine. So I think we passed that. Now we need to go back to the original terms and conceptualizations, which actually reflect reality as it is. And most importantly, and I listened to your, I think it was previous podcast with Andrew Mogdan on grand strategy. And I completely agree with him. We need to stop underestimating Russia. And I think you asked him a question about the Russian economy about his book, and he provided an excellent answer. I the only thing that I can add to this, we tend in the West compare Russian economy to the economy of Spain or Portugal or Italy, which is fine. On numerical size, it is what it is. But I don't remember Spain or Italy having the biggest nuclear arsenal, the largest territory in the world, one of the most developed space programs, one of the most developed nuclear energy programs, and so on, which is an interesting now conversation. It's either there is something in Russian corrupted economic system that they can do more with less, right? Which probably is not the case. Or there is something very wrong in the way we look at the world. So on the concluding note, I will say we need to go beyond this hybrid warfare. We need to see the things for what they are. And most importantly, instead of being driven by the discourses of the others, we must start being driven by our own discourses and by our own vision of the world that we want to live in.
Yes, I definitely would encourage our listeners to also listen to my interview with Andrew Monahan on Russian grand strategy. It really overlaps quite a bit with our discussion. Now, usually we like to end our interviews by asking our guests, what are they working on now? And you just came out with another book, Strategia, is that correct?
Strategia was published last year. It's a completely new book, which is not my book, practically. During my engagement with many people from academia, but also many from the military, I found myself trying to explain how Russians think. This is kind of my bread and butter. And I got tired from this understanding. So I decided a few years ago, okay, fine. You don't believe me. I'm going now and I'm going to translate Russian strategists for you to read in English. So Strategia is actually, I wrote a very nice introduction to it, but the rest are just translations, my translations, for several prominent Russian strategists, either from imperial times or from exile, became very prominent after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it's mainly an attempt to put something on the table of a Western thinker who doesn't read Russian to get an access to the original text and put them into the heads of Russian thinker. So this is all done already. What I'm working on now, unfortunately, the Kremlin been keeping us all busy with policy relevant analysis and trying to interpret what is going on and how it might go in the future. So it takes much of my time, but there is another project that I'm working on, which is related to strategic thinking in general, but Russian will be a part of it, Western will be a part of it. It's trying to explain that or investigate how different worldviews manifest themselves in the way cultures, institutions, societies think about strategy.
That sounds very fascinating. Maybe when you complete that project, we can have you back on the podcast.
I will be most happy to do that.
Friedman, thank you for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New Books Network. I am your host, Steven Sakevich, of the Russia and Eurasian Studies channel. Until next time.